There's a lot of room up there, but space is filling up with junk. Old satellites, bits of rockets, random debris of all kinds. One estimate suggests there are about a million pieces of junk from the size of a pea to a clenched fist in space now. Academics study waste in space these days, and last week they held a conference in Canberra under the title Space Domain Awareness and Space Traffic Management. One of the keynote speakers was Professor Aaron Rosengren from the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at the University of California, San Diego. And he joins me in the studio now. Aaron, welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So space is filling up with junk.
Yeah, I mean, we've been tracking objects since Sputnik, and you know, the growth rate of satellites and launches, even up into the 90s, has been pretty linear. It's only in more recent times that we're seeing an exponential growth of objects in orbit, and this doesn't just include our satellites that we rely on for communication, navigation, weather, everything. That really makes our modern world what it is. But we also have now a serious issue with space debris, which comes from anything from fragmentation events, so a satellite just exploding in space, to collisions. And we've had at least one collision between two intact satellites. That was Iridium Cosmos, and that occurred in 2009. We also have had
two satellites just bashing into each other.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic as well, because at the time, space traffic management wasn't really a term adopted yet. We did monitor, at the time it was NORAD, and it became the Space Command, but it's now the 18th Space Defense Squadron monitors all the objects, provides conjunction data messages, which tells the operators, hey, you need to maybe maneuver. There's a chance a 1 in 1,000 would be a threshold, or 1 in 10,000. You need to maneuver your spacecraft, or else a collision could occur. At that time, Iridium was active. It was part of a constellation, and Cosmos was a defunct former Russian military satellite.
So it was a dead one hitting a live one.
Well, it was more the live one hitting the dead one, because Iridium actually maneuvered that day doing their normal orbital maintenance maneuver to get it into the zone that it needed to be in, and it actually maneuvered into that collision. But at the time, prior to this Iridium Cosmos conjunction, there was not a report that it was at danger, and this is an issue. So they didn't think that there was any risk, and of course they maneuvered, and then that new computed risk was not fed to them in time, and they collided with a defunct debris, and some of that debris is at altitudes of at the time, it was the most congested region of low Earth orbit, which was at 8,000 or 800 kilometer altitude regime, where we have our sun sink orbits and a lot of other things. But these debris will last for tens to hundreds of years in orbit.
Okay, now let's get some terms right. Low Earth orbit.
Yeah, so for a long time, we've used these altitude classifications of circumterrestrial space, so things that orbit the Earth. Low Earth orbit is the altitudes from the 200 kilometers, so basically the altitude at which you can orbit at least once before you re-enter on account of atmospheric drag, all the way up to the tenuous regions of the atmosphere, so up to 2,000 kilometers altitude. It's called LEO, low Earth orbit, and as you go beyond that, you have medium Earth orbit, which is a terrible name to describe everything between low Earth orbit, again at 2,000 kilometers altitude, up into the geosynchronous region, which is about 7 Earth radii from the center of the Earth. So it's 42,000 kilometers from the Earth. And that's geosynchronous because the orbital periods are commensurate. They're the same orbital period as the Earth's rotation period. So the things will stay put. So that's kind of what you can think of as our our national space, right? Our airspace. It's something above a country, but of course it's only in the equator. And so we have geosynchronous, we have LEO. So we call that GEO. We have
and
LEO.
Just on LEO for a minute, low Earth orbit. That's where all the commercial satellites are?
Not necessarily. We also have a lot of things in GEO and geosynchronous orbit.
And all of these have junk in them?
Every regime has debris, yeah. We're also even finding things that were launched in the Apollo era. Even though they've escaped the Earth-Moon system, they've went into heliocentric space. Some of those are returning.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Aaron Rosengren about junk in space. And his voice, ladies and gentlemen, is the voice of a man who has been speaking at a number of conferences in Australia, most recently in Canberra, Space Domain Awareness and Space Traffic Management. Now, Aaron, junk can be tracked?
Well, certain junk can be tracked, right? You know, the catalog that you can download publicly on SpaceTrack, this is managed by the 18th, there's about 26,000 trackable objects. Those are about the size of your cell phone in LEO, up to about a meter in GEO. We track those from ground-based capabilities like optical telescopes and radar. We track about 26,000 pieces of object that could cause a catastrophic failure to a spacecraft if a collision were to occur. There's also about a million, as you said in the beginning, a million pieces of objects that are predicted. Now, these are predicted based on what's called debris evolutionary models by NASA. ESA and all the other space agencies have various modeling capabilities that project kind of like a forecast of what the debris population will be like and what it is because of fragmentation events that have already occurred of objects that we just can't see. But we're imagining that there's probably about 500,000 objects that can cause a disruption to our satellite services that we simply can't see at the present time.
Okay, and none of this can be cleaned up. You can't send an immense vacuum into space and clean up the junk. Your eyes say otherwise, Aaron.
No, so the focus largely has been on mitigation. How do we stop polluting what is already there? And you know, in LEO, things will come down naturally. Of course, the lifetimes depends critically on the altitudes. And so some things can stay in orbit for hundreds of years. But we now think about ways in which we can leverage the natural dynamics to maybe mitigate the potential for collisions, right? How does Starlink orbit so many satellites in such a narrow band of space and not have to worry about collisions? It's not because they're doing their autonomous collision avoidance. It's because they've designed those orbits in a very meticulous way, leveraging astrodynamical theory from, you know, the early age of the space age. So all these theoretical foundations are finally finding a way to help with space sustainability efforts.
So junk can be mapped and tracked, and people sending satellites into space, rockets into space, can actually track their way through or past or around the obstacles that are floating out up there.
Yeah, and this is done, of course. As we start to launch more and more mega constellations, Amazon Kuiper is going to go online here pretty soon. We're going to have a big debris and active satellite field in which to navigate through. Now, space is quite big, right? We know from the Hitchhiker's Guide, and that's true. So it's not like what you see in Star Wars in the asteroid belt, right? It's even in the asteroid belt, you can't go from one asteroid and even see the other one with an optical system. So things are very spread out. But of course, the issue is that they travel at really large speeds, and of course, they're not coming back. So think of air traffic control, where at least they land and then take off. Things in orbit will, you know, from low Earth orbit, will orbit about 15 times a day up to GEO, which is one orbital period per day. And then when you get to beyond GEO, which is the area that I study quite extensively, you have these long dwell orbits, multi-day periods. They're hard to track because they're very far out. So the low signal to noise ratio, they're very dim. So that's going to be an issue too, is how to track things that you can't really see.
Sounds like somewhere that needs rules. And that might have been hard enough when space was a matter of governments, but space is now a private enterprise. How do you tell Elon Musk to obey the rules of dealing with his own junk?
Yeah, it's a bit of a tragedy of the space commons. Well, industry managed to regulate by themselves the geobelt, because the geobelt is a critical resource. Things that are slotted in GEO, at the end of their life, they move them to a graveyard, not because they're good stewards of space, but that's because they want that slot for their other capability.
That's where they make their money.
That's where they make their money. And they have all operators have an interest in protecting GEO, because one collision in space doesn't just pollute that regime. It actually goes and can permeate all of the orbital zones. And in fact, when you get even beyond geo, objects that collide or objects that fragment, that's going to be a huge prediction issue. We don't know where those objects can go.
Explain to us all why there has been this extraordinary leap in the number of satellites or whatever going into space. Up till about 2015, the graphs looked pretty level, nothing much, you know, no very dramatic change. But suddenly in 2015, the line is vertical. Why?
Yeah, it's a direct reflection of the cost of launch. It has dramatically decreased. And as a result, like SpaceX, it's changed the cost to get into orbit. And so you now have also smaller components, smaller satellites that are able to do incredible things. We're launching, you know, maybe not the same megalithic satellites that we're doing before, but we're now looking at a collection of satellites to do some kind of application, not just constellations, but satellites flying in formation to maybe do observations of exoplanets, like having a distribution of satellites in formation. So not just that the cost have gone down, but we've seen application now in terms of components and the smaller sort of electronics market.
How big are satellites these days?
Depends.
Depends, of course. How small can they be and how big can they be?
So we have something launched by Advanced Space, and this is a CubeSat. I think it's a 3U CubeSat. So it's about the size of a fridge, mini fridge. Then you have things like Integral, which is a megalithic, you know, 2-ton bus that's just beyond geo. That's going to come down in 2029. So we have things that range in scale, and also it depends on the cross-sectional area, what you're talking about. So if you have a big solar sail attached to your spacecraft, that presents a bigger cross-sectional area for a potential conjunction.
Right. Oh, conjunction. What a beautiful word. Not collision.
Yeah, we don't use collision. Conjunction. Conjunction, yeah.
Wow. Hey, design for demise. What's that? I'm going to go through some of the language now.
Yeah, let's go through.
Because it's great. Design for demise.
Let's go through some of the astronomical parlance or astrodynamical parlance. So that is the idea that as we re-enter, a spacecraft will fragment, will completely ablate in the atmosphere, leaving no trace of it on ground. Now that is a notion that the European nation, ESA, they wanna advocate for, because in this case we don't have any risk of casualty on ground.
What about cone of shame? This sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so the cone of shame was the moniker given by, I think, AFRL, Air Force Research Laboratory, and then the Space Force to indicate the region that is in front of the moon and also behind the moon. So it's a conal region from the Earth extending to the moon. Now, the cone of shame is called that because if you're trying to look at objects orbiting there, you have a bright moon behind you. So if you only have optics, you have the issue with signal-to-noise ratio, right? You're not supposed to look at the sun, right? We don't do daytime observations for a reason. So this is the issue with the cone of shame, is that the thought is that if objects are dwelling near the Lagrange points or even at the moon or behind the moon at the other Lagrange point, then we're not going to be able to see them. So it's a shame.
It's interesting. Aaron, it's interesting. It's not quite as interesting as I thought it might be with a name like that.
Yeah.
But look, tell me very, very seriously, are there weapons in space?
Well, space, according to the Outer Space Treaty, is not supposed to be a domain for weapons. As to whether they exist, I don't even have a clearance to tell you that. certainly it's a military domain. We use assets in space. If you go download the public catalog, now there's a number of objects that are not listed in that we do track. Now those are military reconnaissance satellites. And so you could think of those as being a form of weapon in space. And these are things that provide communication and regimes. And of course we see with the Ukraine-Russia conflict, we see where certain, you know, commercial entities can even be involved in these conflicts. So,
well, if a satellite can tell me which side of the street my car is parked on, as it can, then no doubt it's very useful in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Aaron, can you reassure us that we are not going to be killed by falling space debris anytime soon, wandering around? And can you reassure us that Mr. Musk's rockets aren't going to be torn to shreds by shrapnel hanging about in the zones above the Earth. Is this a future danger we're talking about here, or a present danger?
It's a future danger that if we don't take it seriously in the present time, we could end up doing long-term damage to our ability to operate in space. And not just that, I think the cost of getting into space is going to increase if you have to insure your satellites. Satellite insurance, that, you know, you might not know this, is an actual thing.
I've never thought of that. There's satellite insurance.
The cost of operating in space could go up if we don't take it more seriously in the present time. And there's a lot of initiatives, and I think Australia has also a unique geographical vantage in order to assist the global efforts in this domain. And of course, that the conference that I went to in Canberra, that's I believe the fifth iteration of that, but that has gone back many, many years, decades before, to other efforts that have been done in this region.
Aaron, thanks very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Really great to be here. Thank you.
I've been talking to Professor Aaron Rosengren, who has just given the keynote address at the Australian Space Domain Awareness and Space Traffic Management Conference in Canberra. And Aaron is a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of California, San Diego. This is Late Night Live.